Welcome back to the Placeholders Podcast, everybody. I'm Kaylee Fretz. Joining me today, Dane Cash. Welcome.
Hey, Kaylee. How are you?
I'm excellent. And Kit Nicholson, how are you?
I'm all right. I'm recovering from the worlds.
We've got quite a lot to talk about today. We're going to talk worlds, of course. There's a couple storylines left over from the World Championships, things we didn't get to discuss last week, things like the start line controversy in the mountain bike race. We're also going to get into Richard Freeman. That has come to a close, maybe a conclusion. Not particularly satisfying, I think, in a lot of ways, but we'll get into what exactly that means. We're going to talk a little bit transfers, transfer corner. There's quite a lot going on right now. It's open transfer season. Dane's going to give us a little insight from the National Cycling League. Went to a bike race over the weekend. That was kind of weird, but kind of fun.
That's a decent, yeah, summary.
We'll get into exactly what that was like later in the show. And then, of course, we've got your daily pain. And we're going to have some daily pain at the end of today's episode.
Weekly pain at this point.
Sorry, weekly pain. I keep calling it daily pain. Weekly pain. And we haven't really figured out what weekly pain wins or loses the people on this podcast. But there will be some kind of jeopardy involved. And I am keeping track of points. It was, of course, a tie last week. This week. So I think a tie is 0 points for anybody. So basically, that was a practice run. We start this week. It's your opportunity, Kit and Dane, to come away with some points. Are you excited?
Very.
Always.
Before we get into today's show, we got to thank some of our lifetime members at Escape Collective. It was just a huge thanks, basically, to Chris Prattley, Roman Elsner, Simon White, Stephen Gilmartin, and Elizabeth Orthe. I hope I pronounced that correctly. We love you all very much. Thank you for being lifetime members of Escape Collective. Of course, everything we do, including this podcast, is supported by our members. So if you haven't signed up, head over to escapecollective.com/join. Get yourself signed up. Please and thank you. All right, we want to kick off with Transfer Corner here. There's quite a lot going on at the moment, Dane. In fact, there's quite a lot happening just in the last few days. We're going to hit on some of the big ones. Biggest, perhaps, Mikel Landa to Quickstep. That dropped this morning. What do we think about this? This to me, is the best indicator so far that Remco's not going anywhere.
I love this transfer for many reasons. I think they're going to send Remco to maybe the bigger races, and Landa's going to be their kind of second. I don't think Landa's going to be riding for Remco, put it that way.
Really? I think he is.
I think he is, but he won't.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean. I don't think Mikel Landa is going to be interested in that. That's not Landismo. That's not how he rolls.
Yes, that is absolutely true. But at some point, does he have to sort of acknowledge the fact that he's not going to win a Tour de France, because he's not, and step into more of a, you know, like a Yates role for Tadej Pogacar, for example, this summer, where at some point, you know, you reach your 30s and you're like, well, I've sort of seen what I could do here. It is not win the Tour de France. I can now go get paid a bunch of money to help this other rider out. Now, the argument against that is that Quickstep doesn't tend to pay a bunch of money. If you were going to do that, you'd probably go do it for UAE or somebody else. But still, I have to imagine that this is... So it goes one of two ways here, right? It's either Landa's showing up to ride for himself, and that is potentially means that Remco actually is leaving, or he's showing up to be the super domestique that Remco is demanding, or else he's gonna leave.
I think it's option three, which is Landa goes to the Giro, and I think the Quickstep benefits from having a rider to get them UCI points, because Landa's gonna finish somewhere between fourth and seventh at every Grand Tour he races. Generally, that's what he does, and I don't know that necessarily means that he will be not riding for Remco, because, you know, you can go to the Giro and then be a good teammate. But I think they're going to give Landa some room to ride for himself.
There's also a good chance he's got a good bonus package, which might give him the oomph to get some decent results, which always adds some drama to the races that we're watching. And then maybe that's trying to set him up for a bit more of a nest egg as he approaches retirement, or a bigger deal at the end of his contract with Quickstep. So I think it could be a really good outcome for Lando. I'm not sure how great it will be for Remco.
If I was picking up a super domestique, that isn't who I would pick, which is a pretty good argument against that being the case. But still, I don't see, you know, we had some sort of like rumors floating around, some quotes floating around from Remco's father in recent weeks, basically saying that he's been talking to other teams and they're looking for support for Remco that he's not currently getting. And I don't think those are idle threats. I think that is likely very much what Remco is thinking right now. He knows that he is not going to straight up beat Pogacar and Jonas Vingegaard at a Tour de France without a much stronger team than he currently has. Is that Mika Landa? I mean, he could be. This is the interesting thing about him as a rider, right? Like, he could be an absolutely phenomenal, in the same way that Yates was really good for Pogacar this year. Like I said, he'd be a great domestique if he wanted to be.
I want to make a kind of semi-related point, which is I really love when family members dish to the media. It allows the rider, or really any athlete, they can kind of say what they want to say, or maybe not. Maybe they don't want their family member to speak to the media, but then we get it. It's always dramatic, and I love it. So thanks to Remco's dad for, you know, joining that club.
And the great thing is that Remco would really like him to shut up, if we're to believe that is the case.
That's what they
but
say.
There's also, if he's yet to sign a contract, which I'm sure that's the, well, or he's, or he's yet to have that proper discussion with Lefebvre. You know, maybe there's money on the table, and this is all helping with the negotiations. But yeah, after the time trial, he said, if these conversations are going to continue through the Vuelta, it's going to be a long race. It's like, I'll have a word with your dad, mate.
What do we think? So what's the conclusion here? Is Mika Landa, is Remco staying? Is Mika Landa coming to help? Or is Mika Landa staying free and riding for sixth at the Giro?
Yeah, I think Lando's going to stay free to maybe ride for six of the Giro and then go help Remco.
I don't get the sense that Patrick Lefebvre has a whole lot of interest in Mika Landa riding for six of the Giro.
I think that the UCI points that you get for finishing in the top 10 at a Grand Tour are pretty significant. You get a lot.
But do they need UCI points?
They do if they keep riding like they have done this spring.
That's true, actually. But historically,
sorry, I mean,
they're
just piling on Cidar Quickstep, but I don't know. You know, it can't all rest on Evenepoel, and yeah, they've got some good sprinting caliber in their ranks, even without Jakobsen.
Yeah, Jakobsen.
And Luke Lampetti coming in to get some 1.1, 2, 1.2, 1 pro, maybe get some bunch sprints in the likes of the Tour of Poland, that sort of thing. But yeah, they need more numbers, and they know that they have to do something different after this spring, because usually, you know, they banked a lot of points, but they haven't been able to do that.
It's possible that Lefebvre and everybody over that team just sees Landa as having more potential than we're giving him credit for. I mean, I think we've seen Landa finish in these sort of somewhat disappointing, like, kind of, he was there, he's in the leaderboard, but didn't really, you know, factor a lot. And I think that's made most of us think, all right, well, he just doesn't have it. But it's also possible that they see something in him. They see him having more potential than we do.
To push back on you slightly, Mikel Landa is 33 years old. He is out of the prospect zone.
I am 34, and I refuse to say that I will not win a Tour de France anytime soon. That could still happen, and I'm not gonna take this.
I don't think Patrick Lefebvre is the type to look at a 33-year-old and think I can get more out of him. I think he's quite.
No, that's a good point. That's not how he rolls.
Yeah, which is why I wonder, and why I was kind of intimating this at the beginning, whether this is Landa finally being like, okay, fine, pay me a bunch of money and I'll help Remco Evenepoel win a Tour de France. Like, if Lefebvre is planning on hanging on to Remco, I can't see him bringing in a rider of this caliber, of this particular type, without having had that conversation. Basically saying, the reason we're bringing you is because of this guy, not because of your results. I can't see it coming any other way.
That's a good point. And also with Landa, I mean, the thing that he's done best in his career is not necessarily going for big GC, results. It's like stages. It's, you know, KOM jersey at the Giro, that sort of thing. And you could still do that while being a support rider. So there is that element of maybe there is a limited amount of freedom that he gets to have. I can't imagine Landa is just going to slot into being entirely a support rider, but I think at the same time he might also just, yeah, maybe for him the continuation of Landismo is just going to win a stage at the Vuelta, you know, and then also mostly supporting Remco, or like going to race the Volta Catalunya for himself, but then, yeah, being in, I can see that as a real possibility.
So let's move on from Quickstep and Landa. Elsewhere in the transfer market at the moment, we've got Matteo Jorgensen over to Jumbo-Visma, which is something that has been rumored, well, since really ahead of the Tour de France. I asked him about it directly at the Tour, and he just kind of stared at me and was like, I can't talk about that. So it was pretty clear that that was going to be happening. Is this a good move, a bad move for one of the sort of rising stars of American cycling? I mean, you know, nearly won some stages at the Tour this year. Is he going to have more? Is he have more of a chance of winning or less of a chance of winning compared to Movistar, where he basically had like free reign most of the time with Jumbo?
Well, if Landa's getting old, Roglic is getting old faster, or at least quicker. You know, maybe they're lining up because Jorgensen is not quite at big race winning GC level yet, if he's going to be there. But we saw a glimpse of that at the Tour of the Alps, was it?
Romandy,
that's it. But yeah, maybe they're lining him up, and in the meantime, he gets to do a Sepkus and get some big top 10 results in races and give Sepkus a bit of a break, because the guy has become a bit of a mascot, which is maybe good, maybe bad. You know, he's been at every one of their victorious Grand Tours. So it's an interesting one. I wonder if, he's clearly not going to get loads of chances for himself, but he will get some attention, which I imagine he probably didn't have so much of at Movistar.
Well, I mean, and he had spoken previously about like paying for his own altitude camps and like ridiculous things over at Movistar. He's not going to have to do that anymore. And so I think that Jumbo is the team at the moment that feels like it's a place where riders go and get much better than they were before. There always seems to be a team in that that's doing that at any given point in time. And Jumbo appears to be that team right now. And it's why a lot of these riders want to go there. It's because, you know, if you can get an extra 5% out of yourself, if Matteo Jorgensen can get an extra 5% out of himself, he's winning Tour de France stages, right? I see him more. I mean, he's not a Sepkus. Like, he's not a climber like that. He's a much bigger guy. He's like over 6 feet, and he's just really strong, can climb, but he's not the sort of little whippet. He probably has 10, 15 kilos on Sep, I would imagine. But he's more like he could do like a sort of Christophe Laporte stuff, right? Where he's less of a sprinter, but if you have the sort of big team behind you, you can use that to your advantage and potentially win more races than you had, even when you had your own chances. You know, the Laporte Cofidis to Jumbo kind of move, I think, is maybe a good analogy here. And so I think it could be a really good thing for him, or he could just get stuck into like bottle duty at the Tour de France. Like it could go one of two ways there.
I think the Jumbo team has been pretty good to its many, many, many talented riders who, you know, very often have to slot into domestique roles. They get chances. This team is good at divvying up responsibilities enough that, you know, their domestiques get their day, and hopefully that will happen for him.
So good move, bad move?
Interesting move.
Decent move. I don't love it, but I don't hate it.
I like it. I think I like it. I think he's ambitious, and I think Jumbo is a good place to go if you're ambitious right now. So yeah, I like it. A couple other small ones. Lidl Trek, depending on whether you're in the UK or mainland Europe. They've been pretty busy. I mentioned this during the Tour de France podcast quite early in the race, but you know, we were speaking with I was speaking with sort of like the Trek liaison guy between the actual Trek company and the team, and sort of the head of sports marketing and things over there. And he was saying that they go from the sort of bottom third of in terms of budget to the top third. So they're not UAE, they're not one of those big massive, they're not Ineos, but they have quite a large jump in their ability to spend. And I think that that's what we're seeing in the market right now. And they picked up quite a few riders, both on the men's side and the women's side.
Yeah, I'm most excited about Teo.
Have we talked about Teo on this podcast? I don't know that we have.
We have not talked about Teo on this podcast.
Yeah, that's a really good... We should also say his really last good... name.
It's Gegenhardt. You know, I'm not closely friends with Teo, so I guess we could say... It's one of those... I feel like if you have a really unique first name, we as media people tend to just... Like Remco.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Teo Gegenhardt, big signing. I like him being signed here. This is a good call for Trek. I think he showed this year he was in good form before, you know, things didn't really go his way. But this
massive
is a good
crash at the Giro, stage 11, broke a femur. Yeah. So he's still coming back from that. I don't think he's actually...
He's not expected to race again for Ineos.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting juxtaposition to the Matthew Jorgensen transfer, because Teo is clearly... leaving Ineos, where they have an embarrassment of riches, or at least that's what we still say they have. I'm not sure if that's always true.
It's less than it used to be.
Yeah, but still, it's, you know, he's going somewhere that he's going to get much more freedom, I think, is our understanding, and some, you know, he's going to be the leader, at least when he's, you know, at the big races like the Grand Tours. So that's a really, I don't know, it feels like the right sort of environment for him too, because he's a bit more of a maverick than I think a lot of the Ineos riders have come to appear. And that seems to fit better with Lidl Trek.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that Lidl Trek is sort of pivoting back towards GC ambitions, because they basically left those, they haven't even really tried for a couple of years. They like, Giulia Ciccone is not a true GC contender. The last time they were really kind of paying attention to GC was when they had Vincenzo Nibali on the team, and Richie Porte, obviously, podium at the Tour de France in 2020 with Trek. But
this is so disrespectful to Balcomolima, Kaylee.
Yeah, I'm putting Balcomolima roughly in the same category as Giulia Ciccone, which is just never like not really. They're not going into any Grand Tour in the last 3-4 years expecting to win that bicycle race, whereas with Teo they conceivably could, right? And he's 28 years old. He should be at the peak of his powers at this point. Doesn't sound like this injury is going to be one that has any real long-term effects. At least the team don't think that, and Teo Gegenhardt doesn't seem to think that. It's definitely a big one. Takes a long time to recover from, and that will take a long time to sort of fully come back from. But I don't think it's going to be like an Egan Bernal kind of situation. There was never any, I mean, he never spent a night in a hospital on the edge of survival. So I think it's a good move. I think it's a great move, actually, to Trek. It redefines what the team is, which is an interesting thing.
I'm intrigued that he's going to be leaving Ineos when I would think the opportunities would be opening up, with Geraint Thomas sort of reaching the end of his career. You know, Egan Bernal, not quite, you know, obviously not back to the level he was at when he won the Tour de France. So I would have thought that Gegenhardt would have been given more leadership had he stayed. And instead, he's going to move on anyway.
Maybe he just wants a change of scene. Maybe he, because he's been there since he did two Stagia seasons before he signed on with them. So the last one might have been, you know, the beginning of his contract. But still, it's a really interesting move. But it's also, I think, a reflection of how, I mean, I imagine that Trek has looked at the likes of Jumbo-Visma and seen how now you can have a team with multiple ambitions if you've got the right riders. So if you've got Wout van Aert and Jonas Vingegaard and Primoz Roglic, and at Lidl Trek, you can have Mads Pedersen and Teo Gegenhardt at the same race with big goals, and they can achieve them. And whereas I think at Ineos, it's an all-in strategy, and probably the same at somewhere like Soudal Quickstep. So it's I think it's with the addition of their big chunk of budget, it's an interesting step for Lidl Trek, and I think it's also reflective of the team that we've come to see them as, and I think a bit like EF as well. I think they're a similar sort of outfit.
I think their budget is actually now going to be quite close to Jumbo's, which is also kind of like Jumbo sits in that sort of upper third, you know, not UAE like state funded money, not Ineos billionaire funded money. Just regular sponsorship, but a lot of it. I think that's roughly where they are. So in theory, and you find the right riders, they could have aspirations of being the next super team, I think, at this point.
I like that. It's,
that's obviously easier said than done.
It's like state funded, billionaire funded grocery stores. That's your top tier of funding.
Gotta love pro cycling.
Yeah,
gotta love pro cycling. Last two in our little transfer corner over here. We got Fabio Jakobsen moving on, and we have Danny Martinez over to Bora. Dane, I think the Jakobsen one is more interesting.
Yeah, I guess that team has done a good job with some riders, so they have a good track record with some riders, and they have a really, really strong track record of making people want to leave as well. So to me, I wonder why anybody would want to sign there.
I didn't actually say where he's going. Jakobsen's going to DSM.
Yeah, he's going to the DSM team, the team that routinely at this time of year comes out with a press release that says, we're parting ways early, amicably, goodbye.
We've harmed harm.
Basically every year.
Harm has harmed us.
Harm is out of here. Yeah.
Another interesting element to that, though, is that Warren Barguil is going back.
Oh, jeez.
Which is kind of odd. I mean, that Tour de France when he and Michael Matthews, both had like this bromance and getting the green and polka dot jerseys, that was great. But that was the peak of his powers. Maybe that's why he's going back. But I felt like when he moved to then Arkea, well, it is now still Arkea Samsic, isn't it? But when he moved across to the French smaller team, I thought that was around a kind of, he wanted a different environment. He wanted something a bit closer to home. So I don't know what's going on.
I will say that other than the vibes, which constantly suggests that it's a tough place to ride for, I mean, it just feels like that must be a difficult environment. I think they'll be able to support Jakobsen very well for sprints. I think this is a good match in terms of results because they need a good sprinter, and he could use, well, he's doing fine over at Quickstep in terms of results. But if he's going to go somewhere else, he needs a team that's going to be dedicated to him, and I think that's what they have over at DSM.
I agree. I think it's a good move. Clearly, the relationship had broken down with Lefebvre as well, and so get out. All right, let's take a quick break. Well, I think we'd be remiss to have this entire episode and not dig a little bit more into Worlds. Which obviously wrapped up over the weekend. We had the Elite Women's Road Race won by Lotta Kopecky. If you want more diving into that particular race, we have two other podcasts dedicated almost entirely to that race. One would be this week's Pretty Serious Bike Racing, and the other would be Wheel Talk with Abby Mickey. If you want more on that race, head over to those podcasts. We obviously have to split things out here. We can't talk about everything on every single podcast. That would get a bit redundant. But there were some other things that came out of the last weekend of racing that I think are particularly interesting, particularly for this podcast. And the biggest one there was this start line controversy in the men's, in particular, cross country over the weekend. So basically what happened here was there's some random rule, deep in the UCI rulebook, that says if you are in the top, it was a top 10, I believe, of the UCI points in some other discipline, you get moved up in the start grid in the cross-country race. And now these rules are specifically related to World Cups, different thing than World Championships. But the UCI decided they're going to implement this rule at the World Champs. Why? Because they wanted the roadies to be moved up, basically. They wanted Tom Pidcock, Matthew Van Der Poel, and for some reason, Peter Sagan, to be moved up quite a ways in the start order of cross country. Now, just for a bit of context for anybody who doesn't follow mountain bike racing all that much, start order, sort of start grid, is hugely important in cross country. It if you start on the front, it's just a much easier day for you. You do a lot less passing. You could definitely argue that someone starting way at the back, you probably, as a result of that starting position, you have a very low chance of winning, which actually made some of the rides, like Sam Gaze started relatively far back, Koretsky started relatively far back, who finished in fourth. They made their way up very impressively. Anyway, that's the context that's required here. So this gets announced, was it a day or two before the race? 2 days before the race? 3 days before the race? The rider representatives from the pro mountain biker, it's not really a union, but close as they've got over there, they put this letter together that's like, this is ridiculous. We disagree with this. You know, we had to race a whole season to get these start positions, and then these other guys just show up and they get to just use their road points and they get to just get bumped up. And in particular, like riders like Peter Sagan, who is currently 311th in the UCI's road categorization, somehow he gets moved up as well. So you can imagine how the mountain bikers would be pissed off by this entire thing. So then we have the race start. They get moved up to row 5, I believe it was. So like they're not all the way at the front, right? But there's 98 riders in 13 rows in this cross-country race. And so row 5, a lot better than row 13. It's worth mentioning that Tom Pidcock would have only been in row 6, I think, anyway. So he only got moved up one row, but Sagan got moved up a lot. Vanderpool got moved up a lot. And we have the bike race. And in the end, Tom Pidcock, one of the roadies of Roadie Row, ends up winning the thing. We've got Victor Koretsky again in 4th, who he like did the sort of, what's the, it's like the, what's, how do you describe this how movement that I'm doing to you guys right now?
Up yours.
Something mean. Yeah.
It's up yours. Yeah. It's excuse my French here. It's fuck you. Basically.
That's English.
And he's sort of, he's aiming it over at like the UCI commissaires and things like that. So this whole sort of kerfuffle thing happens. And then one of the roadies does in fact win. Matthew Vanderpool ends up falling down in the start loops. That was quite embarrassing.
We should just point out he is the Olympic champion as well.
So here's the thing is I want you guys' perspective on how this all went down and whether it's valid or not. Like, should Tom Pidcock in particular, and I would say Pidcock and Vanderpool are in a very different category from Peter Sagan. Peter Sagan only went backwards from where he started anyway. Should those two have been moved up?
No, but it probably didn't make any difference. Egregious part of it is the Sagan status thing. That's where it gets silly. It also gets silly when you consider that the likes of Blanca Vass wasn't moved up on the women's side.
Right.
Now, she maybe was less likely to win it than Pidcock was. But it's just kind of, as people have said, UCI doing UCI things.
She would have qualified under the exact same rule, though.
Exactly, that's what I mean. Yeah. So that's where it gets. It's the Sagan thing. It's Vanderpool. It's not also featuring in the women's race that makes it just kind of like, for goodness sake, UCI. And maybe Koretsky was at least well founded in his frustration, if not justified in the way he reacted.
If not particularly mature in the way that he expressed it. Yeah.
I'm of two minds. My main mind is, if the rule didn't exist, and it didn't, in specific relation to this event, then you got to follow the rules, and it's silly that they decided to make a change this late. Without rules, we're just animals. And, you know, you got to follow the rules.
Especially when we're talking about the UCI, which loves their rules.
Well, yeah, but they apparently just decided to change it at the last minute here. So in general, I would say I'm very much against this. You got to follow the rules. On the other hand, it is pretty dumb to me. Sorry, mountain bikers, that like, yeah, if you're not in the top few rows, you have no chance. And that's a huge bummer. And we all want to see Tom Pidcock and Matthew Vanderpool going up against... They're really good riders. I mean, like you said, you've got an Olympic champion. You want him to be involved. So it makes sense that there would be a rule for, you know, translating your road results to getting you into the higher start positions. It's just silly that the UCI didn't think of this like literally a year ago. Par for the course for the UCI, but still silly. So I'm fine with that having been the decision if they had decided this a long time ago. But it's the fact that they did it right now, it's just dumb.
It's like somebody put the start list together, realized that Matthew Vanderpool was going to start 94th or something, and was like, oh, we have to fix this.
Yeah.
That's what it reeks of.
Right. Which, again, this is not you could have seen this coming a long, long time ago.
Yeah, because he didn't do it. I mean, well, and even Pidcock. So Pidcock, I should say, Pidcock came out afterwards and basically was like, first of all, I didn't ask for this. Second of all, it only moved me up one row. Third of all, I actually, like, he said, I sort of messed with my Tour de France preparation to do extra World Cups in the lead up to this so that I would be in the row that I was in, right? And I think that's what has the mountain bikers so annoyed, is that they put tons of time and energy and money into going to all these World Cups so that they can get a good start position at things like the World Championships or the Olympics. And then somebody else can just kind of show up. You know, Matthew Van Der Poel, I think, is the Peter Sagan thing, again, I think it's irrelevant because he was never going to, it didn't matter. He was one extra dude in 98 to kind of get in the way. But the Matthew Van Der Poel thing, like, he could have done additional World Cups this spring and moved himself up in another way if he wanted to put the focus on it. And for me, again, I kind of come at this from I used to race a lot of mountain bikes. I can kind of feel the anger there. It puts mountain bike back in this sort of sideshow thing, right? Where you can, if you want to, completely ignore the discipline except for the biggest race of the year and just show up, and you will be rewarded, actually, for ignoring the discipline. I think that's a bit, if you're a pro mountain biker, it may be the reality that your sport is second fiddle to road. It just is. You know, the riders make less money, there's a lot smaller fan base, et cetera, et cetera. But to have that shoved in your face that way, I'm not surprised the response is pretty bad.
Yeah, also they could have, I can conceive of a way that they make changes to the scoring system to even with Vanderpool's just mountain bike results, he's not a nobody on the mountain bike, you know? And even though he didn't do a lot of mountain biking when, yeah, Pidcock was trying to get probably, some of those points.
Probably should have done a little bit more.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, for sure. But also, I want to see Vanderpool.
Maybe he wouldn't have fallen over?
Well, maybe. Like, or I don't know. He's done this before. Where
he's a very... Well, so, I remember having this debate after Peter Sagan flatted out of Rio. Like, Peter Sagan is also a very good mountain biker. Matthew Vanderpool is a very good mountain biker. The sort of, like, 1-2% that you get from racing this all year, I think, is valid. People said, oh, Peter Sagan's so unlucky for flatting. No, it's a man-made, manicured course. It's not like he hit a nail. He hit a rock, I'm talking about Sagan here, and it was not luck, it was skill, right? And Matthew Van Der Poel going around that corner, that was not bad luck, that was some element of skill. He was running exactly the same tires as Sam Gaze, who ended up finishing in second. So it's not like you couldn't get around that gravelly corner with those tires. It was a matter of you know, the 1-2%, a little bit of too relaxed going around that corner. Maybe he just sucks at right-hand corners. Mm-hmm. He also fell down going on around a right-hand corner in the road race. He's not an ambi-turner, perhaps. But yeah, that's part of mountain biking is keeping yourself upright in situations where the terrain is doing everything it possibly can to make sure you're not upright anymore.
I don't want to take us way off course, but I'm extremely irked when commentators, and sorry, Kit, but it's largely British commentators who do this, call things luck that are not. Like, oh,
yeah,
he slid out on a descent. That's such bad luck. No, it's not. It can be, but it's in this case, it's often not. Anyway, it irks me a lot. So
I was going to make the point that emphasizing what you both said, in fact, but his rather bizarre crash in the recon of the Olympics, when he basically just either forgot or didn't know that the route had been slightly changed. On a drop off, and that's you know, you should be able to, you should have known, mate. He's obviously very good at what he does. But maybe that's where his multi-hyphenate status, maybe some corners are cut, and it may not be him that's cutting the corners. It may be his team who said, by the way, they have changed this part of the route, or by the way, there's more gravel than there was, or something like that. But it's there are things that he could have done, or they could have done, to sort it out.
Also, people do crash. Like, people do make stupid mistakes, even if they're really, really good at stuff. Like, it's also possible that he just happened to make some dumb mistakes, one at the Olympics and two at Worlds. Like, that's also possible.
Yeah, and mountain bikers were crashing all over this course. Like, full-time mountain bikers were crashing all over this course. So I don't want to pretend that this is just like he's bad at mountain biking. He's an incredibly talented, skilled rider, but if you ride road bikes most of the year and you hop on your mountain bike a couple times, you are not going to be as good at mountain biking as you could be if you rode your mountain bike all year. That's just a reality. So I think that, it's It's not karma. That's a bad way to put it. But like, it's he clearly was sort of not actually physically, mentally, skillfully prepared to truly compete in that race anyway. I think that's it from Worlds. We enjoyed it. We did last week discuss a little bit whether we were enjoying the Super Worlds concept. And Kit, what are your thoughts on that? Just real quick here. Like, did it work? Was it good? Did we like it?
I think it worked for fans better than it did for journalists. Yeah.
That's always the case, though. The Tour de France is exactly the same way.
I think, from the responses that I've heard in the past couple of days from people who were in Glasgow, but also people who were watching watching from home, people have loved it. The fact that if you were trying to cram in as much as you could and that was physically impossible, that meant that a lot of people were completely cracked by the end of it. That is another factor, but that's also a factor when you come to other things like the Tour or the Olympics. I think on the whole, it was more successful than I was expecting it to be. And I think Glasgow certainly was a good venue.
Like I said last week, I enjoyed the heck out of watching it from afar. The timing was great. There was so much to watch. I was watching things that I wouldn't normally watch. I was watching artistic cycling. I was watching guys hit a small ball with their front wheel into a net playing bicycle soccer. It was great. I wouldn't have watched it. I watched a bunch of BMX. I enjoyed it. I thought it was great. And I mentioned this, I think, last week, and I mentioned in the comments as well, but like, kudos to David Lepartien, the UCI president. I think that's the first time, maybe the last time, that we say that on this podcast. But genuinely, this is his project, and it worked. It worked for the same reason that the Olympics worked, which is you get a whole bunch of interesting sports all in one sort of like place and time, and you just get to consume them as a fan, and that's really fun. So we look forward to Haute Savoie in 2027. I'm gonna book my flights now.
At least the Edinburgh Fringe won't be on at the same time, so Scotland or the destination won't be so bloody expensive.
That'll be good. Oh well, but you know, like I think it'll be like Annecy kind of.
Yeah, Haute Savoie, not exactly the cheapest true. Part.
Plenty expensive anyway. A little close to Switzerland. All right, last before we get into our weekly pain here. We would be remiss not to mention the fact that we have some level of conclusion isn't the right word. What's the word I'm looking for here? Dr. Richard Freeman, no longer Dr. Richard Freeman. His medical license has been removed. And he was just handed a 4-year ban by UK anti-doping. Now, I don't want to go too deep into the story because I feel like most of our listeners probably have been following it. It's been going on for half a decade now. And the things we're talking about stretch back pretty much a full decade, more than a decade, actually. But anyway, Richard Freeman was the official doctor, the head doctor for both Team Sky in its pomp and Team GB in its pomp. And he has been banned for 4 years for ordering a box of testosterone to the Manchester Velodrome, which at the time was the headquarters of both of those organizations, and for lying twice about that. The details of this, I mean, this is an ongoing saga. Like he ended up not defending himself in a number of charges. He had a bunch of sort of personal health issues that made this last even longer than it would have otherwise. But now we have this conclusion, and I'm wondering from you two what you take from it. Like, does this harm your view in any additional way of what happened at those two teams in sort of 2010 to 2015 kind of area?
I think what you described about the very long, drawn-out nature of this saga, the fact that it's been going on for so long. I mean, I don't know how much more the decision to ban somebody who's not going to work in the sport anyway really impacted my view. It's like I already formed the opinion literally years ago when this all of the details came out. Not much has changed really in the past several years on this story.
No, and it remains murky, and I think it will remain murky for quite a long time. But I also think that it's more You know, yes, we know what he's been charged with, and I'm going to be careful here, but I think there are things that have not changed my... Well, this outcome, this decision, hasn't changed any of my opinions about any of the things that have happened. I think this was fairly inevitable, particularly as he has been unable to defend himself, as he said. I think it speaks to something... Well, it speaks to the slightly murky nature of the grey area that, you know, is in the sport. And it's not to say that I believe anyone was definitely in the wrong, although somebody clearly must be, I think.
Somebody.
Well, yes, no, and I think, you know, he probably did, but it's what else was going on is what is the what remains in my mind. So this doesn't really change any of that. But I think this is just one more step. The saga is long from over, I think.
Yeah, I think the frustrating thing, if you're following the sport and you've been following the story, is that we really have not gotten really any closure. I mean, this doesn't really... We didn't find out who this was for, really. I mean, this was something that was kind of left unknown to us. And yeah, very murky. So all we really know is that Freeman kind of takes the fall as the doctor, and the person who maybe was involved in attempting to get this substance, whether they were, you know, as he claimed... somebody working for the team but not actually a rider, or whether they were actually maybe a rider, contrary to what he said, we don't know. And that means that we didn't really get much out of the quote-unquote, you know, closure. There really wasn't much.
Yeah, all quite unsatisfactory, I would say. Listeners out there, you can probably hear us with some level of reticence to discuss this in too much depth because, one, so many things aren't facts. And so for us to just sort of speculate, I think is actually quite...
potentially damaging for anyone involved.
It's and potentially damaging for us if they decide to sue us for it. So we do have to be relatively careful. I think that what we can say is... if this was like, imagine if this had happened with a like non-English speaking team, right? The judgment, I think, would be quite decisive from the general fan base. And I think that if you sort of put yourself in, if you take yourself out of the context of like, we understand this team a bit better than, you know, let's say it was Astana or something like that. You know, people would have their judgments, and I think the fact that we're a little bit closer to this team, and that this team is one that that we understand a bit better, has led to a little bit more kind of benefit of the doubt. But just the pure facts of the case, the fact that you have a doctor ordering testosterone, working for the dominant team and dominant nation of that era, is not a good look. And not a thing that makes me look back at that period and have a whole lot of trust in almost anything that happened at this point.
I would say that I still have a lot of respect, and I do like a lot of the individual riders on that team. But it's you know, this sort of thing and some other stories that you can't escape in cycling mean that it, you know, there is that sense that you can only really follow individuals and not really a team, because you get that cultural, as you say, you know, if it was Astana, there are certain members of the Astana administration who you can't really trust for a number of very demonstrable reasons. But for that, on the other side of the coin, you've got this team that we're specifically talking about, Team Sky, with the line that they would not cross. And that, I think they even had a poem, didn't they? Or kind of a mantra that they had in the early days, even etched into their jersey, that there was this line that they would not cross. And they were so... stubborn in their beliefs, that it raises a lot more questions when something like this happens, and it's just, yeah.
It makes me wonder whether that line is where we thought is the line we thought they were talking about. Where's
how,
the line?
How wide is the line as well? is it a line or an area? Gray one.
Yeah, exactly.
To your point about Astana, I think it does. It's a good comparison because I on the other side of that, I think that the fact that this is a British team with ties to government-funded sport, the good part of this is that it means British government gets involved. I mean, this is like a big investigation. I don't really know.
That's why this was uncovered.
In Kazakhstan. Exactly, yeah. You know?
Yeah, that, very true.
And
very
I also think British journalists are really, really good at attempting to dismantle their own national pride. And they, I mean, they were all over this story for a long time. And again, that I think also helped it kind of come to light, the fact that so many talented journalists were from non-endemic media, from not just the cycling media, were going hard after this story for a long time. That helped it come to light. So there is an aspect of it, you know, being, I think it's a good thing that it was a British team and that I think we were more likely to find out more stuff about what happened because of the quality journalists and the government inquiry.
Yeah, I mean, just to reiterate, like, this was a medical tribunal that uncovered and determined most of these things. UK anti-doping is basically just running off the back of that government agency and investigation. And so, as we've said many, many, many times on this podcast, like, that tends to be what gets things unearthed, is when you bring the power of government and police and all the rest to these things.
Assuming they play ball.
Assuming they play ball.
In Spain, that doesn't always happen. You know,
it pretty much never happens.
Yeah, so like it really depends where you are.
Yeah, and in this particular nation, yeah, that tends to be the result. So anyway, we don't spend too much more time on this because, again, this is like just this last little point on a thing that has lasted 10 years and we have talked about so many times over the years. You know, it doesn't change my opinion in the same way that you said, Kit. It doesn't really change my opinion of what happened, but at the same time, we still don't know, and that's sort of the most frustrating thing. Yeah, you either take one of two sides here, right? Like, you either choose to believe, you choose to trust, or you take the, like, where there's smoke, there's fire. And I think that there's probably not a whole lot of space in the middle at this point, given what this does for me is it puts those two camps into very separate areas. And some finding yourself somewhere in the middle is I think increasingly difficult. So let's leave that there. All right, Dane. Let's bring this back. Let's bring this back to America.
Yeah, we should.
Let's bring this back to American cycling. Yeehaw, cowboys! And tell me about the NCL. You went to an NCL event over the weekend.
I did.
In Denver.
First race. Well, it was in Commerce City, which, if you're not from the area,
Denver-ish. Go Denver Disruptors.
Yeah.
Disrupt away. Do they have a chant? Do they have a song?
I didn't hear any chanting or songs. I did hear some people seeming to be, some fans there seeming to be rooting for them simply because they were the hometown team. That's kind of the point, I think.
Yeah. So what was it like?
It was, there were pros and cons. I would say there was some good, some bad. I'll start with the bad so we can end on a positive note. The bad was that there were very few people there. There were not a lot of fans in attendance in Commerce City. Not that big of a surprise. Commerce City, as I kind of hinted at earlier, is not downtown Denver. It is far from the urban core of Denver. It is a place that you go to watch the MLS's Colorado Rapids. That's where we were on Sunday. We were at the outskirts of their stadium. And if you go there intentionally to watch the Rapids, it's a great place to be. But nobody goes there for other reasons. Nobody would have been just walking by. Earlier this year when they were in Miami, they had a race in South Beach. There, that's a place where people actually are walking by that might see the action. There's no foot traffic in Commerce City. So unless they're going to get the word out and market this thing, nobody's going to go there intentionally. And it seems that they did not do that. They didn't do that. They did not get the word out well enough. There were really not a lot of people there. There was a crit in Littleton a week ago that I think did a much better job of that. And this event, nominally, you know, a big deal because it's backed by so much money. And there are some big name riders. I mean, this is, if you want to watch a former Paris-Nice winner in the U.S., this is your chance to do it. Because Sergio Henao was there. But yeah, not a lot of fans. The audio-visual elements they could have been improved. You needed more screens to see what was going on. This specific format really requires you to be able to follow the scoreboard. Which is what I think makes it cool, but also it means you really need to be plugged into that. I had the GCN app on my phone, so I was kind of following it that way. But yeah, it's just they need a little bit of improvement there. You need to be able to see the scoreboard. You need to be able to hear Dave Toll better, which, like, if you've ever heard Dave Toll, it's really saying something
Dave Hull,
to say that he was hard to hear.
He doesn't even need a microphone.
The guy can project. It's like he's really good at it. So anyway, there were some elements that were lacking. The lack of the fans was really the obvious one, and yet, despite all of those things, and some others, I mean, there's been a lot of turmoil behind the scenes, but I think that's a whole different story. I think the whole point of me going down here was just to see what's it like at an actual race. I came away thinking, okay, in the end, the point system is not that complicated. I thought it was like, okay, what is this new format? And I think that's most of our reaction was, all right, a whole new format, new point system. This is complicated. It's really not that complicated. It was really actually quite easy to follow. And it was cool. I got to see some big names that I wouldn't have otherwise seen. And unlike most other bike races, from start to finish, everything, every lap has the potential to be impactful because there are points on offer. And my hometown Denver Disruptors, you know, they were in the breakaway trying to scoop up points. But in neither the men's race nor the women's race that followed, another cool aspect of this format, by the way, is that they have a men's race, they have a women's race, and it's the combined total of your team's points that matters. That's cool. Anyway, the Denver Disruptors did a good job of getting into breakaways and trying to score points. But in the end, Miami's sprinters on both the men's and the women's side scored huge oodles of points and bested the hometown team.
What?
Yeah. So Miami Knights came to Denver and they won a race on the, you know, on away turf, which Denver had just done in Miami a couple of months ago. So
this is the most American sounding thing I've heard in a long time.
Well, that's the cool thing. That's the takeaway, I think, is that I left the race, and I wrote this in a very long story on escapecollective.com that you should go read. If you have the patience to read about American cycling. But one of the takeaways for me was that I could have relatively easily explained what I had done that day to somebody who didn't know anything about cycling, which is, you know, my soccer team, Liverpool, they drew 1-1 with Chelsea. My baseball team, the Phillies, dropped a pretty frustrating game to the Minnesota Twins. And then my hometown cycling team was bested by the Miami Knights in a race down in Commerce City. So, yeah.
It's notoriously difficult to win away as well. So, congrats to the Miami Knights.
You would think, although the names of the teams are very much, it's not like the whole team is people who are living and training in Miami. Yeah, I don't know.
Thank you, Dane.
You're welcome.
I'm glad that you went and checked it out. I think it's worth keeping an eye on. I think anything with that much money is worth keeping an eye on, basically. Yeah, you know, like we root for cycling things to work in general. I think doing the opposite is just silly. So I hope it works. I hope it gets some momentum. It sounds slightly chaotic.
I think chaotic is a good word to describe it, yeah.
I like the idea of cheering for my Denver team.
Right.
I like that. I think that's great. Like, I still think every once in a while someone will write a piece, a sort of like think piece. It's like, what if the Tour de France was countries or something, which it used to be, by the way. I think that'd be great. That'd be fun, right? Do it one year. Just all the teams, you don't matter anymore. Just France versus the US versus GB versus that'd be fun. That is like the nature of sport. And one of the real problems in cycling is kind of what you were talking about, Kit, when you said you can only follow riders. You can only follow riders. Like, no one, very few people have a team they care about. And is that something we can actually fix? I don't know. But that's essentially what, that's the problem that NCL is attempting to solve. And it's a genuine problem. Like, it's hard to build a fan base when you just care about the individuals and not the teams themselves.
The format is also exclusively teams. So the individual riders do not get the results. So, like, the final result is not that Paolo Munoz won the sprint. It's that the Miami Knights beat the Denver Disruptors and everybody else.
The Denver Disruptors also a pathway to the World Tour now. Was it Riley Sheehan, I think, is going to be stagiaireing in for Israel?
That's the Pro Tour.
Soon. So, okay, sorry. A pathway to the Pro Tour, Kit.
Just sorry for being a pedant.
You know what I mean. Yeah. So, like, congrats to Riley. That's great. You know, let's not root against things that are being built currently.
They have their heart in the right place. I mean, they want to throw all this money at our sport in a place where the situation is dire, which is the U.S. racing scene. So,
yep. Yeah. All right. It's time for Weekly Pain. This is we're gonna use it. We're gonna go to a very traditional game here. This is a very simple game. We played one round of it last week, which is you must tell me all of the teams that a particular rider has ridden for. You're going to go back and forth. If you cannot name one, the other person has to name one, and then they get the point. We're going to do best of three. If you win the whole best of three, you get one. You get a point that I'm going to keep track of, and at some point in the future, those points will be worth something. What? I don't know. We haven't figured out that part yet, but we'll get there. All right, so who wants to go first?
I'll do it.
All right, Dane. All of the teams that Alberto Contador rode for.
Ian taught me to be more strategic in what I say. So I'm going to say Tinkoff Saxo.
Correct.
Astana?
Correct. Dane.
I'll just say Trek. I don't know what the full name of the team was. Were they Trek Segafredo when he was there? Were they...
Yep, it was Trek Segafredo. And just to remind everybody, if teams just change like one sponsor, that's still the same team. So we're not going with all the various iterations. Kit, it's back on you. Da, da,
da, da, da, I'm trying to picture him in various kits.
So you've got the three most recent.
Started properly following cycling in 2012.
You should have at least one more is quite famous. Well, actually, they're all big teams, but one more is like...
I'm going to kick myself, aren't I, when you tell me if I can't get it.
You are absolutely going to kick yourself. The listeners are kicking you right now. Yep. All right, 3 seconds.
I don't know. You have to put me out of it.
What? Back to Dane. Dane, can you do it? Dane, can you do it?
Kate, I'm drawing a blank too.
Oh, no.
I have a guess, just because I can guess. I don't want to go out without a guess, but I'm drawing a blank. I can't think of anybody else.
What's your?
My guess is Leaky Guess.
Nope. Oh, okay. So no points there. So
who was it before Astana?
I need to design these games so that we can't have ties. We have a lot of ties.
Well,
we got
best of three, right? So
yeah, we got best of three. Yeah. We got best of three. So the ones you were missing. Come on, guys. Lance Armstrong and Discovery Channel.
Yeah, Discovery, of course.
Right. Liberty Seguros and Once, the Spanish team of that era. It's all right. Listeners out there, I'm sure you knew those. If you did know those, make sure that you tweet at Kit and Dane and tell them. That's very important that you can tell them exactly how much smarter you are.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Kit, you get to go first this time. We're going to do Peter Sagan.
What was the Cannondale team called? Liquigas. Was it Liquigas Cannondale? Or was it just Cannondale?
It was just Cannondale.
Give me Cannondale. Yeah,
I think, right?
It was just
Cannondale. I'm going with the Cannondale.
Okay.
Total Energies.
Yep.
Tinkoff, Saxo, Bank, whatever it was. One of them.
Yep. Correct.
Bora.
Correct. Oh, Kit, you're doomed. we're in for another tie here. Maybe it's just whoever can't get it, and it's just chance.
But then,
you've got
to pick more strategically, because if the number of teams always lands on the same person, I think Kaylee
That's
should
true.
Lose a point.
All right. who's up now?
Kit's up. Are we doomed because this last one is hard to get?
Yeah, you're never getting this.
Okay.
Was it a Devo team or something?
It was a Conti team, which I am counting. Yeah. There's no point.
Adrian Mobil.
Nope. Have you ever heard of this team? Dukla Trenson Merida.
No.
Yeah, no way.
Well, that means that this one's for all the marbles.
This one's for all the marbles. It's all the marbles. Also, technically, I had Leaky Gas down as well, but you're right that sort of Leaky Gas, Cannondale, that's actually the same management. So just to be clear, rules going forward. If I have made a mistake and I have written down, it's whatever I've written down. That's the rule. So my mistakes become part of the game.
So we have to be telepathic as well.
Yes, that's very important. So I actually added this one just while we were talking about him earlier, because I thought that was fun. For all the marbles, Mikel Landa.
been for every team, hasn't he?
Pretty much. Dane, you get to kick off here.
Bahrain.
Correct.
Movistar.
Correct.
I'm assuming that Quick Step doesn't count.
You can't count that. He can't. If he's going to get a point out of this, you can't give him a Quick Step.
All right. No. That one doesn't count then.
Okay. Astana.
Yes.
Sky.
Yes.
Oof.
We're getting into the deep.
The weeds.
We're getting into the weeds. Yep.
Those are the four that came to mind. So now I'm like, what Devo team did he ride for?
So you guys have gotten everyone back to 2014, and he turned pro in 2009.
Neither of us wrote the news story on his transfer.
Oh, man. Wait, he turned pro in 2009?
Yeah. Again, I'm going all the way back to Conti teams.
Man, he's old. Yeah. Like you said.
He's not. He's no longer a prospect.
Now I'm old. Yeah. Okay. He's a Spanish rider. He probably raced for... Euskaltel.
Correct.
Ah, damn it. That was my guess.
Basque Spanish rider, of course.
I'm done. Has he ridden for anyone else?
We've got two more.
Two oh, more? Really? Jeez.
But you're never going to get them. I think this game is fundamentally flawed. But I enjoyed it nonetheless. I'm going to tell you, and we are for the second week in a row.
Are they Spanish teams?
Yes. Do you want to go for it?
There's only so many of them, right?
We're talking sorry, there's only one more. There's one more Conti team that he
it's Conti
signed
level.
For. I read this wrong. That he signed for in 2010.
Okay.
It's one Conti year level. With this team prior to jumping up to the World Tour with Euskaltel.
Yeah.
I'm gonna give you a hint, and at this point it's whoever yells it out first. All right. This is a Spanish bike brand.
Burgos BH?
Nope.
Okay, then I know what it is, but I've already given my answer.
Spanish bike brand, in particular, from the region that Euskaltel is from.
Yeah, but I'm not a tech person.
It's not the best hint.
They have an office here in Boulder, actually.
They do have an office in Boulder.
The only Spanish bike brand I can think of is Orbea.
That's it.
You are
it?
Correct.
Yes.
Kit wins. 1 point, one big
well done,
point
Kit.
To Kit for this week. Congratulations.
For putting an answer out my ass.
Well, you educatedly guessed it. I mean, you guessed Spanish bike brand was good.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Wow, that was fun. I enjoyed our weekly pain. we're gonna have weekly pain every week, I think. I am going to switch the games up. I have all sorts of games ready. That was just the easiest. I was trying to have one that someone would actually win, and I failed at that simple task. All right. We're going to get out of here. That's the end of this week's Placeholder Podcast. Thanks, Dane. Thanks, Kit, for jumping on. We'll be back next week with another episode. Make sure you check out the rest of the episodes we've got this week. We got Wheel Talk. We've got Pretty Serious Bike Racing. Do we have a geek warning this week?
I'm about to put it up on our podcast channels.
All right, because James is at Breck Epic, so I wasn't actually sure that that one happened this week. So make sure you check out all of our podcasts. Go sign up. escapecollective.com/join. We need you. We need you because you are how we survive. Thank you. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
See ya.